From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the voice of SpongeBob. We talk with voice artist and comic Tom Kenny. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie is out on DVD. The TV series started its new season on Nickelodeon earlier this month. Also, why birds sing and what they're singing about. We listen to field recordings of birdsong with the world's leading expert on the subject, Donald Kruidsma. And we'll hear from Don Stapp, whose new book, Birdsong, is in part about Kruidsma's work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Can I help you with something, sir?
Name's Dennis. I've been hired to exterminate you.
You're gonna exterminate us?
SpongeBob and his dim-witted starfish friend Patrick face a hitman, voiced by Alec Baldwin, in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, which is now out on DVD. This animated film is based on the SpongeBob SquarePants TV series, which is set at the bottom of the ocean and stars a sponge along with his sea creature buddies and sea monster foes. The series premiered on Nickelodeon in 1999 and became the number one kids show on broadcast and cable TV. The new season started earlier this month. Both the movie and the TV series were created by Steven Hillenburg. My guest, Tom Kenny, does the voice of SpongeBob and several of the film's minor characters. He's also a stand-up comic and was a cast member on HBO's sketch comedy series Mr. Show. He's done voices for several other animated series. I spoke to Tom Kenny last fall when the SpongeBob movie opened in theaters. Let me ask you to describe SpongeBob for someone who's never seen the cartoon.
Oh, wow. Yeah. SpongeBob SquarePants is a little square kitchen sponge, even though he was born of sea sponges. It's kind of an accident of nature. But he lives in a pineapple under the sea, works in a fast food restaurant called the Krusty Krab in the undersea community of Bikini Bottom. What else can I tell you? He pals around with an incredibly dim starfish named Patrick Star, has a crabby neighbor named Squidward Tentacles who lives in a giant tiki head next door to him. He's incurably optimistic and enthusiastic and kinetic and he has a cartoon show on Nickelodeon.
Now, if you're doing a voice for, say, a cartoon animal, you know, animals make noises, so you can maybe base your voice on like a cat's meow or a dog's bark or, you know, a bear's growl or something. If you're doing the voice of a human character, humans really speak. If you're doing the voice of a sponge, there's really like nothing in nature to base that on. So how did you figure out what voice you wanted to use?
Which is actually very freeing in a way because there's no template. So, it's kind of a wide open road. But when it came time to come up with a voice, it was just a matter of finding a voice that was childlike and maybe childish, but not a child, non-age specific, enthusiastic, and just kind of weird. And we've finally settled on this elfish helium
voice that SpongeBob wound up being.
And, you know, this weird, you know, that was the fun part, was before it was even a pitch or even a show, and we were just, you know, sitting in coffee shops, irritating people at other tables, going, you know, what would he laugh like? What would his laugh be like? And, you know, how about a dolphin? How about kind of like a dolphin? Like Flipper used to. Yeah, that's good. And you know, it was really a blast.
You mentioned, like, the voice sounds as if it's on helium. Have you ever inhaled helium to see what it would do to your voice?
You know, it's funny you should mention that. In the 7-minute pilot episode that we did, which, as far as we were concerned, might be the only episode of SpongeBob ever made, there was a school of anchovies that invade SpongeBob's restaurant, and you know, just this big school of destructive, like locusts, you know, that just descend on the restaurant and go and Steve Hillenburg actually brought a tank of helium into the studio, and all of us voice actors just
suck on
and it was just, that was the pilot. So I said, boy, if this thing goes, we are going to have a lot of fun.
So did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
Were there voices you came up with for SpongeBob that you rejected?
Oh, yeah. It's all hit and miss on any animated character in any animated show. You're trying to dial in a voice that the creator is hearing in his head. And in the case of SpongeBob and a lot of the shows I've worked on, really it's a matter of just letting yourself be dialed in like a radio or something with the creator going, okay, no, little, add 20 pounds. Okay, now, you know, 5 years younger, and, you know, maybe he has a deviated septum. Okay, yeah, and, you know, and you know, it really is hit or miss. You're zeroing in on this target, and when it hits, it's pretty obvious.
Okay, could you do that for me? Could you add 20 pounds to SpongeBob's voice?
Yeah, which when he absorbs water, I guess it's water weight. I have a tendency to retain water, Terry. This is SpongeBob on a very, I'm feeling very obese and very large today.
And make him 5 years younger.
Oh, make him 5 years younger? This is SpongeBob as a child. I am in Sponge Kindergarten.
Deviated septum?
Oh, deviated septum. I don't know what that means. I'm just a dumb sponge.
No, the movie, the SpongeBob movie, is kind of a musical. There's a bunch of songs in it. You sing a couple. And one mm-hmm. of the songs you sing in the movie is called The Best Day Ever. Before we hear it, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to sing in character?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Boy, I've never talked about that before. Some voices really lend themselves to singing, and even though I didn't really think about it ahead of time, it's just serendipitous that SpongeBob did. It's pretty easy to sing in that voice. La 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 la. My dog has fleas. But you know, there are other voices that I've done where I'm just so glad I don't have to sing in them. You know, if you're doing that guy, there's not a lot of Sondheim-like range that you can tap into. But yeah, SpongeBob really, really is fun to sing as. It's sort of like a weird mix between, you know, Jerry Lewis and the guy from the schlock 70s band Styx. You know, it's kind of
babe, I'm leaving, must be on my way.
It's very weird.
Where do you place that voice in your head?
I would have to say that if I were going to draw a circle around the target area, it would be somewhere between my fairly sizable proboscis and and my thorax. Uh-huh.
It's definitely up in the nasal cavity, back of the throat area. And Bill Fagerbakke, that does the voice of, or it's Fagerbakke or Fagerbakke, he's never told me how to pronounce his name. He says, whatever. I'm not fuzzy. Whatever. But, you know, his voice as Patrick is just all pushed down right into his big barrel chest.
And then SpongeBob is way up here.
So it's kind of a neat contrast between SpongeBob and Patrick Starfish.
Well, Tom Kenny, let's hear you sing. And this is from the soundtrack of the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. And here's Tom Kenny singing The Best Day Ever, a song you co-wrote.
Yes, I did, with Andy Paley, power pop meister.
Okay, here it comes. That's Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob and the star of the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. So you actually wrote The Best Day Ever, which we just heard. Tell us something about your approach to writing a song for SpongeBob to sing.
You know, it was this really fun mental exercise where my friend Andy Paley and I, and you know, if you Google Andy Paley, it's insane. He's produced records by Jerry Lee Lewis and, you know, Brian Wilson and, you know, all these people. But it was very freeing to just put on SpongeBob's brain and say, wow, well, SpongeBob is this unbridled optimist. He jumps out of bed every day and greets the new day with the mantra, this is going to be the best day ever. You know, every day has the potential to be the best day ever, which is, you know, how we'd all like to be. And then by the time we walk out the front door, we're beaten into submission by life. But yeah, it was really fun. And we tried to make the song sound like, you know, we were trying to figure out who in rock and roll history has been most in touch with their inner SpongeBob. And, you know, and it's John Sebastian from the Lovin' Spoonful. You know, he is SpongeBob. Do you believe in magic? You know, Brian Wilson, who will write like this beautiful 4-minute opus about the wind chimes. These are my wind chimes. You know, and it's like, well, you know, they sort of have this naif-like child man sort of sensibility that is SpongeBob. So it's like, let's write a Lovin' Spoonful Brian Wilson Pet Sounds, you know, sort of thing with SpongeBob singing it. And that's where Best Day Ever came from.
My guest is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie is out on DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob, in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, which is out on DVD, and the SpongeBob TV series, which is shown on Nickelodeon. Now, you do the voices of several other characters, smaller characters, in the SpongeBob movie. Tell us about some of those characters and the voices you came up with.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I've always done, you know, SpongeBob has a pet sea snail named Gary that... meows like a cat for reasons that are never explained on the show. And I think just because I was around early on, I've been meowing for Gary for 5 seasons. Meow, meow, meow. And they still record all his meows. I go, you guys have to have a library of every type of meow imaginable. Why are we still recording the meow? And there's also... there's a French narrator that sounds a lot like Jacques Cousteau, and now we see the beautiful manta ray as he swims. And Jacques Cousteau is a great hero of Steve Hillenburg's, and rather than have the usual kind of booming stentorian narrator that you'd see on a cartoon, we decided to have the action occasionally be moved along by this really, you know, flatliner Jacques Cousteau type guy. 3 days later, we find SpongeBob SquarePants, and he's, you know, it's just kind of bizarre choice. And then there's an on-camera kiddie show host that occasionally appears in live action on the show,
named Patsy the Pirate, that is also me, who's got like this sort of chintzy, cheap kids show where he shows SpongeBob cartoons.
So when I see that character, I am seeing you.
That's me. Well, you're seeing me with like a patch and a beard
and a wig,
a
maybe,
hat and a wig, definitely a wig, and a wooden leg often, which doesn't work and is hard to move around in. And actually, after the first couple of patches, we got rid of the wooden leg. But yeah, Patchy's a fun character to do because he's based on, you know, that local kiddie show host that we all had in our hometown in the 60s that showed Popeye cartoons and Betty Boop cartoons and whatnot, that, you know, everybody had that guy. In my hometown of Syracuse, New York, it was Salty Sam. He had a show called Salty Sam's Showboat. And, you know, he was a sailor character that showed Popeye cartoons and, you know, would hold up drawings that kids sent in. And it was just this neat, vanished world of kid programming that's not around anymore in the ultra-slick current day. And, you know, everybody that we talked to on the show had that guy in their hometown, or, you know, that type of guy, and who is also usually the weatherman on the station and also would put a hunch in his back and host the monster movie on Saturdays and did the bowling for dollars on weeknights. It was, you know, those days were really great.
So what were the cartoons you grew up with on Salty Sam's?
Oh, man, I was obsessed with Popeye the Sailor Man as a kid. I think, I don't know, 6 or 7 Halloweens in a row, I was Popeye the Sailor Man, which, you know, is a pitch that probably would not fly now. You know, you go into the big Cartoon Network and go, okay, he's a sailor, and his eye has been poked out, and he likes to punch people. What do you think, you know? But...
Oh, and the real thing is he eats spinach.
He eats spinach, and
wow.
Then he gets strong, and this enables him to punch people harder and beat them up more completely. What do you think? But it was Popeye the Sailor Man, and it was a particular honor for me when SpongeBob and Popeye shared a cover of TV Guide as they did a series of covers featuring the top 50 cartoon characters ever, and they had a cover drawing that was Popeye the Sailor Man drawing his anchor up out of the water, and it's caught on SpongeBob's underwear, and he's just kind of hanging off the anchor looking at Popeye. It was a weird kind of, I don't know, like full circle cosmic moment for me.
So when you were a kid and you loved Popeye, did you do the Popeye voice and that kind of Popeye mumble that he's always doing as he's walking and thinking?
I loved that. Yeah, that thing that Jack Mercer, the voice of Popeye, you know, he was Popeye for 80 years or something. You know, he was incredible. And I also loved the Looney Tunes, you know, Bugs and Daffy, of course, and, you know, Bullwinkle and Rocky were huge for me. And even those early Hanna-Barbera cartoons like Yogi Bear and Huckleberry Hound and Top Cat, you know, they had, even when the animation was fairly limited, the voice work was really great. And from a really early age, I was conscious of the fact that there were grown men whose job it was to help bring these things to life. And it seemed like a really fun job to me. I had an aunt, a very hep aunt, who, when I was a kid, gave me a bunch of Stan Freberg record albums, like History of the United States and all that. And they had little biographies of the voice actors on the back of the album, like, you know, Stan Freberg, June Foray, Dawes Butler, you know, people like that. And they were amazing. I was very aware that there was a guy named Mel Blanc whose name was on every cartoon. But, you know, in the pre-internet world, it was kind of hard to find out about that stuff. You had to sort of feel your way around. But that only made it more kind of mysterious. You know, I liked to, I don't know, I felt like there was this whole hidden world of cartoons and voice acting that needed to be uncovered by me.
So did you have a sense when you were a kid that you wanted to be a voice actor?
I did, yeah, I did. And by the time I was a teenager, it was firmly in place. In fact, one of my best friends from first grade on is the comedian Bobcat Goldthwait. And we met in first grade and you know, are still close at 42 years old or whatever. And he reminded me recently of a conversation that he and I had in high school, like just kind of, you know, kind of walking around your hometown where there's no show business and playing this game of whose career do you want? if you could have anybody's career in show business, who would you want? And this was probably 76 or 78. And Bob reminded me of this conversation we had where he said John Belushi and I said Mel Blanc. And he said, wow, isn't that weird that you sort of did it. You're doing the same kind of work that Mel Blanc did. And I said, yeah, that is weird. Like, I wanted to be an astronaut, and I kind of got to go up in space a couple of times. It's cool.
I don't know how Bobcat Goldthwait still manages to have a voice, because the voice that he does sounds like it would just rip up your vocal cords.
Yeah, I know. I don't either. He has vocal cords of steel. He is more than human. But yeah, we met in first grade. We went to the same Catholic school, but we were in separate first grades, and the first time I became aware of Bob was when the nun that taught his classroom just dragged him by the ear into the nun that taught my classroom, and his nun was crying, and she just threw him into the classroom and said, I can't take him anymore, sister, you have to, this Goldthwait boy, and I said, whoa, I have to get to know this boy who can make a grown nun cry. It was really bizarre, and so him and I... He was the only other kid that had an interest in that left field kind of, you know, stand-up and sketch comedy. And when SCTV came on the air, it totally blew our minds. And we went to see Andy Kaufman perform in Syracuse when we were... And, you know, it was cool to have another person who was into that stuff so you knew that you weren't crazy. Because, again, now, you know, a kid can get on the internet and just, you know, immediately be in touch with, you know, how many hundreds of like-minded square pegs. But, you know,
it wasn't that way back in the 70s. We had to find other nerds to talk to. Ourselves.
There's one really funny memory I have. You know, Bob was the quintessential fat kid that was the class clown. And I was the quintessential shy, skinny kid who didn't have the guts to be class clown, but considered himself the class clown's head writer.
You know, I mean, hey, try this during math class, Bob. It'll work for you. You know, that's a good sound. Try that one.
But, you know, I have a great memory of us in gym class, and they were picking teams for basketball. And, of course, Bob and I were both just hopeless at sports. And, you know, funny as a defense mechanism, that old chestnut. And it came down, they were picking teams, and everyone got picked except Bob and myself and this little girl who had a hook for a hand. And Bob and I just look at each other, and the captain of the other team says, "I'll take Susie." The girl with the hook for the hand walked over to play hoops. And Bob and I just looked at each other and just started laughing. You know, these like, you know, fourth graders just laughing our heads off at how stupid and hopeless we were. Even now, I can't explain how perfect that moment was, where it's just you and your other nerdy friend and the girl with the hook, and the girl with the hook goes off to play basketball, and they're going, "Yeah, Tom and Bob, it doesn't really matter what team they're on. They're just there to make us laugh anyway."
Tom Kenny will be back in the second half of the show. He does the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants. The SpongeBob movie is out on DVD. The Nickelodeon series started its new season this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Now that we're men, we can do anything. Now that we're men, we are invincible. Now that we're men, we'll go to Chelsea, get the crown, save the town, and Mr. Krabs. Now that we're men, we have facial hair. Now that we're men,
I change my underwear.
Now that we're men, we got a manly flair. We got the stuff, we're topping up to save the day. We never had a chance when we were kids. No, no, no. But take a look at what the mermaid did. Ha, ha, ha. Patrick, conquer some slack.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, publisher of Madame Bovary's Ovaries, A Darwinian Look at Literature by David and Nanelle Barash. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's the call of the northern mockingbird. Coming up, we listen to recordings of birdsong with the world's leading expert on the subject and with a journalist who has written about his work. Also, we continue our interview with the voice of SpongeBob, Tom Kenny. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Kenny. He does the voice of SpongeBob in the animated SpongeBob SquarePants TV series and the SpongeBob movie, which is out on DVD. The TV series debuted on Nickelodeon in 1999 and started its new season earlier this month. Tom Kenny is also a stand-up comic and has done voices for many cartoons, including Futurama, Powerpuff Girls, Johnny Bravo, and CatDog.
How did you break into voice work?
You know, fortuitously, I was doing stand-up one night at the now-defunct Improv in Santa Monica, and there was a person from Nickelodeon and also a person from what was then Hanna-Barbera in the audience, and they they both approached me the same night and said it was a showcase, and they said, "Geez, have you ever thought about doing animated voices for cartoons?" And I said, you know, maybe every day of my life, perhaps. Where do I sign? And yeah, that was it was great. I really felt like, you know, once I did the first couple of them, the first one or two were extremely terrifying, and then I felt like I had just found this suit that fit me so well. It was like, wow, this is what I was looking for. You know, this feels even much better and righter to me than stand-up does. It was a blast.
What is the most devious thing you have ever done with your voice?
Oh boy, that is very weird. Well, I have to say, occasionally, parents who are maybe a little pushy will foist their kid on you and just say, "This is Mr. Kenny. He does SpongeBob. Do SpongeBob. Do SpongeBob for Timmy, Mr. Kenny. Do SpongeBob. Do SpongeBob. Do SpongeBob." And then you do the voice, and the kid just, you know, they're 2 years old, so they don't understand why this man with 3-day stubble is yammering SpongeBob in their face. It's terrifying for them. So that's kind of unwittingly evil on my part, but I sort of get hornswoggled into it. But I just know that kid is going to be on a psychiatrist's couch somewhere down the line. "So tell me again when the sponge man yelled in your face. And that made you cry?"
Have you ever used a voice on the telephone or in real life to get somebody to do something that you wanted them to do, but you didn't want them to know that it was you who was behind it? You know what
Ooh,
I mean.
That is a great question, and boy, I've never been asked that. There was a time when I was first trying to get stand-up comedy bookings and trying to book gigs, where I posed as my own agent. I invented, because I was so bad at tooting my own horn and pushing myself, which I was just awful at. But you know, as this guy, you know, I was able to go on and say, "Hey, this is Tim Golden, and I'm representing a kid who he's dynamite. He's dynamite. This kid does voices. He does characters. He's very funny. He's headlining all the clubs and colleges here in the Bay Area. He's wonderful." And, you know, it was very freeing to be able to be somebody else while you're selling this product.
Did it work?
Believe it or not, yes. It actually, I actually did manage to book a fair amount of gigs that way. And, you know, it was the 80s. There was this huge comedy boom going on where all you had to do to make a living as a stand-up comedian was not be terrible. All you had to do was avoid sheer awfulness, and you could make a living. So it's like, wow, you know, I don't want to set the bar too high, but I think I can be slightly better than awful. I think I can make a living at this.
Do you ever get recognized by your voice, since you don't really use your real voice in your work?
No, actually, this is a character that I'm doing right now. This is, this is really hard for me to do right now. No, my real voice is kind of uninteresting and vanilla and, you know, nasal, you know, Syracuse accent. And, you know, if I wasn't able to twist it into various shapes, you know, I'd be working in a store. Like, I see guys like James Earl Jones, and they've got the voice. They've got that voice, and it's what they do. And it's a gold mine. It's a, you know, if I say Darth Vader's lines, it doesn't have the same cachet. "Hey, I find your lack of faith disturbing. Okay, I must have those plans." But, you know, so, you know, like the guy that does the trailers, you know, "In a world where a man's voice goes down at the end of every sentence," it's like, wow, that guy really talks like that. I've run into that guy. That really is his voice. And he really does do the thing where he goes down, then. Like in promos, you listen to promos and you realize that it's all about the word then. You know, "On a very special CSI Toledo, then. On Buffy. Then, on a very special Pretty People in Their 20s, cellulite is discovered on Sarah." With a, you know.
Have you really met that guy?
I have, yeah, man.
He gets a lot of work.
He's the guy. I mean, it's him. You walk around, you go, wow. Yes, I'm ready for my car now. It's like, I love it. You know, like, I can make fun of that, but I can't really do it.
Oh, you just
did
it?
And you have to be able to reference the word masterpiece in illimitable ways, you know. It's been called a small masterpiece. Critics are calling it some kind of a masterpiece. It's being hailed as a masterpiece. It's like, wow, if everything's a masterpiece, that makes everything sort of generic. If it's all a masterpiece, it's all.
Well, Tom Kenny, it's just been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
And thank you very much, Terry.
What voice was that?
That was
my Mr. Haney hillbilly voice from Green Acres.
I don't know. No, I think that was I did interviews all day today voice. That's Flem. That's Mr. Flem, my new character that I'm working on.
Tom Kenny does the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie is out on DVD. The TV series started its new season on Nickelodeon this month. Our interview was recorded last November. Coming up, we listen to some amazing bird songs with one of the world's leading experts on bird song and a journalist who wrote a book about him. This is Fresh Air. Why do birds sing, and what are they singing about? My two guests are absorbed in those questions and get enormous pleasure from listening to birds sing. We're going to listen with them to some amazing recordings of bird song. My guest, Donald Kruidsma, was recognized by the American Ornithologists Union in 2003 as the reigning authority on the biology of bird song. He's written a new book about the art and science of bird song called The Singing Life of Birds. My guest, Don Stapp, is a nature journalist. His new book, Birdsong and Natural History, is in part about Kruidsma's fieldwork. Stapp is a professor of English at the University of Central Florida. Don Stapp, Donald Kruidsma, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd actually like to start with birdsong. And what I'd like to do is play the song of the common yellow throat. And Donald Kruidsma, in this recording, we're going to hear it both ways. We're going to hear it at regular speed, and then we're going to hear it slowed down to half speed and then to quarter speed. Tell us what to listen for.
Well, this is a beautiful yellow bird with a black mask. In spite of that, called the common yellow throat. What you hear is a song with four phrases, and you might call it witchety, 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 witchety. But once you slow it down, you hear each one of those notes rising, and sometimes they'll rise, fall, and rise very rapidly. Things will still happen very rapidly, but if you could see this sonogram, see it in your mind's eye, you would see that sweep up and down very easily.
Here's the song of the common yellow throat, and we'll hear it at regular speed, and then we'll hear it slow down, and then slow down even more.
Fantastic.
Let's talk a little bit about the chickadee. Donald Kruidsma, would you describe the chickadee song before we actually hear it?
Yes, it's such a nice, simple song. And in the field guides, you'll see it described as fee-bee, but I personally prefer hey, sweetie. So throughout mainland North America, most of North America, you hear two main whistles. The first whistle's higher than the second, and there's a little break in the second whistle, so you hear two syllables, hey, sweetie. So that's the mainland North America song. The Martha's Vineyard song, why, you've got something completely different there.
Now, do you write lyrics to most bird songs, like the hey, sweetie that you just described?
No, I don't write lyrics to most of them, but I needed something so that I could rephrase that lyric to accommodate all these variations on the vineyard. So on the vineyard, we have sweetie hay, for example, or sweetie sweetie, or so sweetie sweetie, to indicate where those little pauses are in the main whistles.
I'd just like to say one thing about this, which is Don referring to it as hay sweetie, for instance, is something that naturalists have been doing for a long time because it was difficult to figure out how to remember what the song sounded like. So we kind of all these mnemonic devices to remember bird songs. So we've got all these, you know, the barred owl says, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" Is the phrase we use. And what, you know, bioacoustics has done in the last 50 years with tape recorders and audio spectrographs has made it possible to grasp these songs by looking at them on a graph and not needing to have to remember how they sounded.
Well, why don't we hear the Black-Capped Chickadee's "Hey Sweetie" song, and here it is. For some reason, that bird song sounds so in sync with the Western scale. It, you know, that bird has perfect pitch. He keeps coming back to the same pitches, and then he changes key. it sounds so in sync. It sounds like the bird's been taking music lessons. And I'm not talking about like the beauty of the song, but just how it kind of fits in with the structure of Western music.
Yes, there is one thing you ought to know, and that is the pitch ratio between the "hey" and the "sweetie" stays constant as he transposes this song over this range. So it's really quite a remarkable song.
Are birds born with songs, or are they taught certain songs?
If we could have the answer to one question in all of bioacoustics, all those of us who study birdsong, I think we would love to know the answer to that question. Yes, these songbirds, 4,500 of them, learn to sing just like we learn to speak.
In what sense is it similar?
It's the learning component. The songbirds, 4,500, they have a sister group, a very closely related group, and the flycatchers belong to that group. In that group, the songs are more or less encoded right into the DNA. A young bird does not have to hear anything in order to know how to sing perfect songs for that species. But for these songbirds, this yellow throat, this chickadee that we heard, these are songbirds. They have to hear from adults just as we, as people, as children, need to learn our speech patterns from parents. And young birds babble, young people babble. So striking similarities between how these songbirds acquire their songs, how we acquire our speech, and the parallels between them.
Well, on the CD that comes with your book, Donald Krudzma, that you have one track of baby talk. Is that because you wanted to make that comparison between how certain young birds learn their songs and how babies learn to talk?
Yes, I love that comparison. We can listen to that track of my daughter when she's about a year and a half old. She's uttering all of these words in a nonsensical sequence, and we can tell where these words belong. She uses bow wow for dog, diddy for kitty, wee, 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 and she hears the little piggy's homeward cry in the story that we've told to her over and over. And then you look at the song graphs or the sonograms for the adult wren and compare what the baby wren does, and you see this same kind of nonsensical sequence. Everything is taken out of context. The youngster is just babbling away, practicing everything. So my daughter and this young wren, these young songbirds, are doing exactly the same thing.
Well, let's start with your daughter. Here's your daughter babbling at a year and a half. Okay, and why don't we now hear the adult wren and then the baby wren. What should we be listening for, Donald Krudzma?
Oh, with the adult wren, you'll hear four songs, and they are sharp and crisp, and this adult knows exactly what he's doing. And he'll sing one of these songs up to 50 times in a row, then he'll go to another one and sing that one 50 times in a row. But we're hearing just one example of each of these long series. Then you listen to the young bird, and you hear this amorphous babbling. And the little bits that will eventually become the adult song, they're all taken out of sequence. They're, one is sung before the other. They're strung together in this long sequence, very unlike the sharp, crisp singing of the adult.
Okay, let's start with the adult wren. Okay, that was the adult wren, and let's hear the baby wren, who is just learning how to sing, and this is kind of like a babbling baby. It's a little, well, nonsensical. So, okay, we just heard the baby Buick wren imitating, not perfectly yet, what he's heard the adults sing. You actually had a breakthrough in studying wrens. You learned that they don't necessarily learn to sing from their fathers. They might learn from their neighbors. Can you talk a little bit about that breakthrough?
Yes. I was a graduate student at the time and looking for a good research project. And after a lot of reading, I realized that nobody really knows where a young bird gets its songs. Where, for example, these Buick's wrens that I was studying, where does that young male get his song? Well, the female doesn't sing. She's the architect of everything the male sings, but she doesn't actually sing. So the choices for a young male are either his father or other birds after this young male has left home. And what I found after a wee bit of work, banding lots of baby birds, putting little bands on their legs, following them along as they move from their birthplace to where they would settle for the rest of their lives, and this could be about a mile away or so, I found that these young birds were certainly capable of learning their father's songs, but then they rejected all of those songs so that they could sing the songs of the males that were around them on the territory that they would hold for the rest of their life. So they had to fit into this new community. Father's songs meant nothing in this new community because, after all, it was a different dialect, and dialects change over very short distances, up to a mile or so.
Well, let's hear another bird song, and I thought we could hear the song of the barred owl. And some of these sounds sound to me almost like chimps or roosters. They're really interesting. But before we actually hear a duet, a male-female duet of barred owls, let's start with a recording that just kind of is simple and breaks it down. Don Kruedsma, what are we going to hear?
Well, the first recording that we're going to hear, it's very simple. There are simply two sounds. The first is by the female, and the second is by the male. And what we've always known is that the female has a higher-pitched voice. Even though she's much larger than he is, this is just the reverse of most birds, even though she's much larger than he is, the pitch of her voice is a little higher. So the first sound that you hear is a you-all by the female, and the second one is the you-all by the male. So listen for the higher pitch in the first one, the lower pitch in the second one, and then what became part of my story was I discovered that the female has much more vibrato. It's a you-all, and it drags on, whereas the male just stops short, you-all. So go ahead.
Okay, here it is.
You hear the striking difference in both the pitch and the amount of vibrato.
Uh-huh. Well, you want to hear a duet now? What should we listen for?
Sure, let's listen to a duet. So now that we know the key difference in how to tell male and female, now you can start to tell, well, who's contributing and actually how to this duet. So you always listen for this pitch difference, the higher one being the female. But then when the sounds are so different, you can no longer rely on the pitch. Then you rely on that vibrato to tell which is the male and which is the female.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay.
That's the duet of the female and male barred owl. My guests are ornithologist Donald Kruidsma, author of the new book, The Singing Life of Birds, and nature journalist Don Stapp, author of Birdsong, A Natural History. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are ornithologist Donald Kruidsma, author of the new book, The Singing Life of Birds, and nature journalist Don Stapp, author of Birdsong, A Natural History. Donald Kruidsma, I've been choosing all the tracks from the CD that comes with your book, and there's, you know, like about 90 tracks on it. I want to ask you to choose a personal favorite or one that's particularly popular with people. Would you do that?
Oh, my favorites, I think I always gravitate towards the thrushes, the wood thrush, the hermit thrush. They are routinely considered among the most beautiful songs in North America. It's the song of the wood thrush. And let's first listen to a normal wood thrush singing at normal speed. And what I'd like to have you hear are these soft little bup, bup, bup notes at the beginning of the song, and then a loud, bold, whistled prelude, and then the ending, what I would call a flourish. And that flourish happens so rapidly that we can't appreciate what's going on. So let's listen first to the overall details of, roughly 10 songs.
Okay. So those were some of the details of some of the songs of the wood thrush. What should we hear now?
Okay, so we heard that loud prelude in the middle of the song and then the ending flourish. I want to zoom in on that flourish on the end because to our ears, things happen so quickly there that it sounds like just a blur. But what happens when you pull this song apart and slow it down to 1/10 its normal speed? It is just exquisite. Because this wood thrush, like so many songbirds, uses two voice boxes simultaneously. So he's singing a duet with himself. And so you can look at the sonogram, and these are a figure in the book. You can see the contribution from his left voice, and you can see the contribution from his right voice box. And in some songs, the left and right are tightly coordinated, beautiful sine waves moving in harmony across the page. But in others, the two voice boxes are quite independent. But whether they're tightly coordinated or independent, the effect is just really striking. So in this next recording, what I've done is to present only the left voice box first, be just a few seconds long, 5 seconds maybe, then 5 seconds of the right voice box, and then you hear the left and the right together in harmony. So go ahead and play that.
Okay.
That was one of those flourishes, if we could pause there just a minute. So the left and the right voice boxes in that first flourish are doing something quite different. In this next one, the left voice box and the right voice are doing pretty much the same thing. They're beautiful sine waves in the figure, but they're non-overlapping in pitch. So the first voice box is low pitched, the second one is higher pitched, and you play the two together and you just feel this this wonderful harmony.
That was really wonderful. That's the song of the wood thrush. And, well, I thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Ornithologist Donald Kruidsma is the author of The Singing Life of Birds, The Art and Science of Listening to Birdsong, which comes with the Birdsong CD. Journalist Don Stapp is the author of Birdsong, A Natural History. Our interview was recorded last March. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage, from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Academy Award-winning movie editor Thelma Schoonmaker. She's edited every one of Martin Scorsese's movies, from Raging Bull to The Aviator. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.